Morality is relative, but virtues are absolute. In other words, each tradition, each culture has got a moral code which differs from one culture to another. So that what is regarded as immoral in one tradition might not be regarded that way in another tradition. So just to give an example, I mean, in Islam, there is a kind of general prohibition on alcohol. In Christianity, we drink wine in the most sacred ritual. So the difference in moralities, but the virtues are the same everywhere. So, you know, humility, generosity, veracity, compassion, all of those things. Doesn't matter whether it's ancient China or the Australian Aborigines or whatever, these virtues are to be found everywhere. And there is a, this is another kind of pervasive idea, there is a kind of inextricable link between the nurturing of virtue in the human individual and the attainment of wisdom. So in other words, you can't have an evil sage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I've had the great pleasure of meeting a newly discovered author, scholar, friend, and deep spiritual thinker, Kenneth or Hari Allmedo. Kenneth Allmedo, born in India in 1947 to Christian missionary parents, spent his early years immersed in Eastern cultures. Formative influence on his lifelong engagement with spiritual traditions. He studied history, politics, and literature at the Australian National University, continued at Sydney University and Oxford, and traveled extensively through Europe, North Africa, and the subcontinent. His master's thesis on Fritjof Swan and the Traditionalist School earned a Sydney University Research Medal and was later published. Allmedo served as coordinator of philosophy and religious studies at La Trobe University, Bendigo, also teaching literature and cinema. He earned a doctorate in cinema studies and received several academic awards, including for his book Journeys East. A prolific author and editor, Kenneth Allmedo has published over 15 books and edited numerous volumes, including works by Fritjof Swan and anthologies like The Betrayal of Tradition. His work explores perennial philosophy, interfaith dialogue, critiques of modernity, indigenous traditions, and the sacred view of ecology. In retirement, he continues to write, travel, and photograph, living with his wife in Bendigo, while staying connected with seekers and scholars worldwide. So it was a very rich, thick, in the good sense of the term, conversation with Hari, talking about especially the notion of traditionalism, or as we have preferred to term, perennialism, or the possibility of finding the same substantial, eternal, timeless truth present in different traditional religious forms, and on the nature of reality as unchanging and paradoxically as in constant growth and evolution at the same time. What else we talked about, the role of myth and symbols in art and in religion and in spirituality, the difference between esoteric and exoteric dimension of reality, modernity, how the pros and cons of modernity, basically how to find a common ground to appreciate and embrace the diversity that we found, not only in traditions, spiritual traditions, religious traditions, but overall. So this has been the conversation. We invite you to join us in the table. This is the Free Radical Podcast. And to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. If you feel nourished by the conversation, like it, share it, drop up your comments to keep this conversation ongoing. So without further ado, dear friends, this is Kenneth Allmedo. So welcome, Hari. Thanks so much for joining us in the Radical Podcast. It's my pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. So as I was reading your bio, and before we go to the main theme I would like to address today, I realized that you were born in India.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't born there. I went there as a baby. So.
But you spent almost the first decade of your life right?
That's right. Yes.
So, if you allow me, I'd like to, on a more personal note, to begin there. What has India been for you, and what is India for you today?
Yes. Well, having lived there for pretty much the first 10 years of my life, it obviously left a deep mark on me. Hard to say precisely what, but I've always felt like India is my second home, my spiritual home in a way. I've been back several times as an adult, and an interest in Eastern religion, Eastern tradition has been part of my work over the last 40 or 50 years. So, yes, India has played a very important part in my life, just as I think India can play a very important role in the life of the world, so to speak. There's much we can still learn from India, especially ancient India.
Thank you. So also from your bio, I mean, our listeners will notice that the remarkable scope of your work, from spirituality to cinema, to ecology, to interfaith dialogue, traditional native cultures. But today I would like to concentrate a little bit on a book that I happened to read recently, authored by you, which is Traditionalism, Religion in the Light of the Perennial Philosophy, that was recommended by a Christian monk and priest, which is a friend of mine. Uh-huh. And basically he told me, we were talking about René Guénon, because I happened to visit his place, in his headquarters in France, so to say, last year. In that conversation came the concept of traditionalism, and my friend really recommended this book, and I trusted his advice, and I do not repent. Of course, it was a very enriching experience. So I'd like maybe to begin with on that note of what is traditionalism, because when referring to traditionalism, you, for example, speak of, one way of speaking about that is a cross-cultural acknowledgement of a timeless wisdom that has carried many names across time, like Philosophia Perennis or Lex Aeterna, Hagia Sophia. In our tradition, we'll call that Sanatan Dharma, as you know. But that's how will you define traditionalism?
Yes, okay. Well, the first point I'd like to make is that although I called my first book by that title, Traditionalism, I feel more comfortable with the term perennialism these days, because traditionalism's become a term which has been used by quite a few different groups and movements, some of which are close to what I'm going to call perennialism, but some of which are not. I think the term traditionalism can be a bit confusing for people, so I prefer the term perennialism. So what do we mean by perennialism? Well, that's a complicated question, but I'll give you a short answer to start with. My understanding of perennialism derives largely from Guénon, as you have alluded to, Frithjof Schoen, Ananda Kumaraswamy, Titus Burkhardt, these sorts of people. Now, their view of the perennial philosophy, which, as you say, is a idea that's been in circulation for some time, but their idea of the perennial philosophy is very coherent and very precise. So it refers to the inner wisdom of the great historical religious traditions and the great mythological traditions of primordial peoples. And it is characterized by a set of immutable principles which don't change over time. They don't evolve or grow. They've always been there, and they're still there now. So to understand the perennial philosophy, We need to study these different, if we want the widest kind of view of it, we need to study how these principles manifest themselves in different traditions. Now, a very important point, the name that most people associate with the perennial philosophy is Aldous Huxley, because of course he wrote the famous book, The Perennial Philosophy, back in 1945, I think it was published, just about the same time as Gagnon's book, actually, The Rate and Quantity. They came out more or less the same historical moment. Now, what Huxley proposes is, yes, there is a sort of inner set of principles which are more or less the same all over the world, at least overlapping to a large extent. But what he suggests is that we can detach that wisdom from the traditional context in which it, in which we find it, in Hinduism or Buddhism or Christianity or wherever. We can distill the essence of the perennial philosophy and separate it from all of the religious forms, the scriptures, the rituals and so on of this or that tradition. Now, in that respect, Huxley radically parts company with the perennialists proper, as I will call them, because what Shuon in particular, who's been more interested in the religious dimension of things than some of the others, what Shuon says very clearly over and over again is that to understand and to reach this inner core, this inner wisdom, we must go through the forms rather than bypassing them, so that we understand a universal wisdom through the particular forms of this or that tradition, and we do so by fathoming those forms, so to speak, by going into them at their deepest level, so that we come to the perennial philosophy through the forms. So this is a very important distinction between Gagnon, Shuon and company and other perennialists. And, of course, there are a lot of other people who have preached a kind of universal religion of some sort or another. And these, again, have got quite a different message from the perennialists, who reject all ideas of a kind of syncretic religion, a universal religion that's drawn all these together. From our point of view, there can only be this religion, this religion, this religion. You can go through any one of them to get to the universal truth, but you can't dispense with them. You can't have this wisdom in a vacuum, so to speak. So to get back to your original question, that's why I prefer the term perennialism rather than
perennialism.
The other point is that in the West in particular, traditionalism in the last decade or so, two decades, has largely been associated with two groups who, although they might share some ground on a different wavelength from Shuon and company. So first we've got the traditionalists within the Catholic Church. So a lot of people, when they start talking about traditionalism, turns out that's what they're actually talking about. They're talking about a sort of group within Catholicism which rejects, you know, Vatican II and all of the developments since then. And the other people who are sometimes called traditionalists, the most important figure is Alexander Dugin. I don't know if you're familiar with him or not. He's a Russian philosopher, but very political, a sort of political, a right-wing political ideology, which, as I say, shares some ground with Gagnon in particular, but there are important differences. So to avoid confusion with either of those groups and some others who call themselves traditionalists, perennialism is a more satisfactory term from my point of view.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification, and I'm very much in favor of using as precise words as we can to convey the whatever idea we are trying to convey, and how one word can really take us to many places we do not intend to. So Yeah. So you are mentioning in one sense that the stance of perennialists, we have just explained, following the the line of Guénon and Schwann and Ananda Kumaraswamy and so on, proclaim that there is a changeless, eternal, timeless truth, which is somehow represented, embodied in particular traditions across time and cultures. So I have here a few quotes from your book that I would like also to share with you and ask your thoughts, because in this connection, I have a quote from you that says, a tradition is not static. Traditions are dynamic. If needs be, they can grow, branch out, and blossom. However, the principle of continuity, which preserves the link with the revelation, must always be respected if the tradition is to remain an integral one. So, of course, I don't find any contradiction between this quote and what you just said, but I was curious about hearing your thoughts in terms of, okay, you say a tradition is dynamic or can be dynamic, can grow. So, well, in which sense do you conceive that in connection to the notion of changeless eternal truth?
Yeah. So, the changeless truth doesn't itself change, obviously. It's changeless. So the truth is the truth. But there are different ways of expressing the truth. The truth can be expressed in an infinite number of ways. And the terrestrial conditions change over time, whether we're looking at the earth as a whole or whether we're talking about this culture or that culture. Things change. We know that. Everything changes. So it becomes necessary to keep re-articulating the truth in new ways which are consonant, so to speak, with the times.
Yeah. So
there are two ideas here which are slightly might appear contradictory or paradoxical, but they're not. So the two very important themes in perennialist writings. One is the theme of decline. So unlike the sort of modern Western view, the perennialist view is not progressivist. It's rather the opposite, that things are best at their point of origin. The general notion is this: things are best at their point of origin, and over a period they decline, eventually become decadent and collapse. So the perennialists reject the sort of, you know, evolutionist, progressivist kind of view where everything's getting better and we know more and more and so on and so forth. So that's one theme. Now, next to that theme also is the idea that the possibilities in any particular tradition are there from the beginning, but they're, a lot of them are latent. They're implicit, but they haven't yet manifested. They haven't yet shown themselves. If I can just give you an example, Schwann, talking about the medieval cathedral in Europe, says, "Well, the early Christians had no need of a cathedral. They were living in a kind of spiritually vibrant community. They were close to the point of origin, the appearance of Jesus in the world. So it's only over a period of time, only over a period of decline, that it becomes necessary for things which were implicit to now become visible. So, you know, the theology of Thomas Aquinas, say, or the medieval cathedral, these don't contradict the tradition. They're in keeping with the tradition, but they appear at a kind of providential moment in time. So this is all part of the notion that, yes, traditions grow and change and they adapt to new circumstances. Of course, the problem for people on the ground, for practitioners and believers, is being able to discriminate between changes and adaptations which are useful and which are in conformity with the tradition, and changes and adaptations which are a betrayal of the tradition and which destroy the tradition if they're not held in check, or if we don't retain a kind of firm purchase on the original message, the original principles, then things will collapse and the tradition will become decadent. A nice image that Burkhart uses, he says the growth of traditions is like the growth of a crystal. So I don't know much about geology, but crystals kind of attract particles to themselves, but they only attract particles which will fit into the structure of the crystal. They don't attract just any old particles, but only the ones that are suited to the inner structure of the crystal. And that's what a tradition is like. So it's a mistake to think of a tradition as a static given datum that's, you know, unchanging through time. The truth is unchanging. The fundamental principles are unchanging. The message of the tradition in question, let's say Buddhism, for example, the message of Buddhism is always the same and that should never change. But the way in which it's expressed and the sort of needs of a particular historical moment determine that, yes, things can't always remain the same. The inner core remains the same, but the outer forms can undergo some sort of change. Yeah.
Thank you. Also, in this connection, I'm also reading, recently started reading this one, The Transcendent Unity of Religions.
Yes.
It's strong. Very interesting. And so far, for me, one of the main points he seems to make in making his case for the transcendent unity of religions is the difference between the esoteric and the exoteric dimensions of each religion, right? So so in this connection, I like to share something that you say in your book on traditionalism that says the problematic relationship of the esoteric and exoteric domains is more fundamental than the relationship of the traditions one to another. If this relationship were clarified and understood, then many of the questions about the interrelationship of the religious traditions will simply dissolve. Or, to put it differently, the problem, quote-unquote, of religious pluralism can only be resolved through a penetration of the exoteric barriers with each tradition, which each tradition has erected. So I invite you, if you want, to elaborate briefly on the difference between these two dimensions, exoteric and esoteric, and how why they are so important to really be successful in our project of establishing an actual transcendent unity and not a sentimental one.
Yes, among reasons, right? Yes, quite so. Okay, so the exoteric dimension of religion is the one with which the vast majority of believers and practitioners are familiar. It's all the forms of that tradition, you know, the scriptures, the rituals, the architecture, the forms of worship, so on and so forth. Now, it is in the nature of things that most believers will take it that their religion is true, and other religions might be more or less true, but they are somehow not as good as the religion in question. In some traditions, this has resulted in a sort of exclusivist view, which is, you know, we're the only ones that have got the ultimate truth. That's particularly so in the Western traditions. The Eastern traditions have been more hospitable to other religions and other points of view, but there's still the sort of notion that our religion is the best religion. Now, that's okay. That's okay. That's not going to change. That's in the nature of things. That's why people belong to that religion. It's part of their commitment to that path, to that tradition, and we don't want to dilute that or qualify that. But the esoteric perspective is able to see beyond the particular forms of this or that tradition. What Shuan says somewhere is that the exoteric point of view, which is to say that of the vast majority of people, the exoteric view particularizes universal truths. In other words, a universal truth is identified with a particular person, a particular scripture, a particular doctrine, a particular symbol, a particular myth, whatever.
Hyper-localized.
Hyper-localized, yes. That's a nice way of putting it. The esoteric, if the exoteric particularizes the universal, the esoteric does the opposite. It universalizes the particular. In other words, it can see in this or that doctrine, in this or that tradition, it can see a universal truth. So not a Christian truth, a Buddhist truth, a Hindu truth, a universal truth. Now, this ability to see the inner truth, the universal truth, the timeless truth, as expressed in this or that form, that's a kind of gift that not everybody has. Only a comparatively small number of people can grasp, can resolve this apparent contradiction between the particular and the universal. So this has sort of implications for all sorts of things, including interfaith dialogue. But what Shuan says is that interfaith dialogue is most profitably and creatively pursued by people who have an esoteric rather than exoteric outlook, which means, for example, it means that they will not start from any position of exclusivism. They will start with a more open, a kind of larger view, so to speak. And they will not have the difficulty in reconciling the apparent differences between religions. Because, of course, if you just look at the surface of things, people say, oh, well, you know, let's say Christianity's theistic and Buddhism's non-theistic. So there's a fundamental and irreconcilable difference between these two. That's an exoteric point of view. An esoteric point of view says, no, yes, it's perfectly true. There's a significant difference here between a theistic approach and a non-theistic approach. But if we look into this more deeply, we can see that these are two ways of approaching the same truth. There's not a fundamental contradiction there. There's only a formal contradiction, a kind of visible contradiction in the form. So this requires some, you know, mental agility and subtlety to be able to grasp these differences. But it's only when those differences are understood in an esoteric light that interfaith dialogue really becomes productive, which is not to say that, you know, what we might call lower level endeavors are worthless. I'm not saying that, and I don't think Shuan's saying that. But as you say, often it's rather sentimental rather than based on a real intellectual discernment. Yeah. So people come together, they've got good feelings, they've got good attitudes towards the other people, but there's no kind of intellectual basis for a coming together or a kind of resolution of the differences. So you can only go so far. Goodwill, in other words, goodwill will only take you so far. You need more than goodwill. You need a sort of understanding of these principles that we've been talking about.
Yeah. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, And I appreciate your point on this particular approach to esoteric and exoteric in the context of interfaith dialogue, because I tend to engage in some of those conversations and I've been able to witness a little bit of these both options that you are showing. And many times interfaith dialogue can become spiritual bypassing even. Right, like a way of externally, exoterically talking to one another, but as a way of convincing myself that I'm open to talk to other traditions, but without making the actual necessary effort to go to the esoteric dimension and really have a conversation from that foundational commonality that we share, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm recalling one quote from Schwann that you mentioned in your book. He says, "Wisdom does not lie in any complication of words, but in the profundity of intention."
Yes.
So somehow, I don't know, I'm relating that to this sometimes. In interfaith dialogue, there may be words.
Yes.
But where's the intention? Where's the connection, right?
Yeah.
And in connection to the experience that comes from the esoteric dimension in terms of the transcendent unity of religions, could you briefly share a few examples of the, I don't know, the most, some striking commonalities that you've seen across traditions?
Right. Yes. Okay. Big question. So what are some of these, fundamental truths that appear in different forms all over the Is that the question? That's the question you're asking? Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry that I know each question is a separate podcast.
From the perennialist point of view, from the esoteric point of view, some of the things that all integral traditions, that is to say all traditions worth the name, some of the things they have in common are the notion that there are levels of reality. There's a kind of absolute reality and there's a relative reality. In different traditions, we give these different names, but all traditions have the view that there is an ultimate reality. We can call it the absolute if we want to use a sort of term that's not tied to any particular tradition, but in different traditions we will find different names, you know, Brahman or the Tao or Nirvana or God or Allah or whatever, depending on the tradition. But there is a ultimate reality which is beyond time and space. It is unchanging. There is a relative reality. There's the world of time and space. There's the here and now. There's the world you and I are living in most of the time anyway. And our human vocation, so to speak, is to understand the distinction between these two different realities, to understand where we're situated in this framework, so to speak, and to understand that we have within us something of this supreme, unchanging reality. Mm-hmm. So that's a very big kind of idea, but that's something that they all have in common. One could catalogue a whole lot of particular kind of notions, you know, that there's life after death. We're not just material beings, we're spiritual beings in a embodied form, spiritual beings in a material form at this moment in time, at this particular place. So again, this is an idea that's in all of the traditions. It's dressed up in different clothes, it's expressed in different words, different images. This is something universal. The principle of what in the East is called karma is something that's more or less universal. The affirmation of virtues, Schwann says somewhere very nicely put, that moralities are relative, but virtues are absolute. In other words, each tradition, each culture has got a moral code which differs from one culture to another. So what is regarded as immoral in one tradition might not be regarded that way in another tradition. So just to give an example, I mean, in Islam, there is a kind of general prohibition on alcohol. In Christianity, we drink wine in the most sacred ritual. So there are differences in moralities, but the virtues are the same everywhere. So, you know, humility, generosity, veracity, compassion, all of those things. It doesn't matter whether it's ancient China or the Australian Aborigines or one of these. Virtues are to be found everywhere. And there is another kind of pervasive idea. There is a kind of inextricable link between the nurturing of virtue in the human individual and the attainment of wisdom. So in other words, you can't have an evil sage. There's no such thing. Being a sage, being a wise person, entails a certain moral purification and renunciation, so that knowledge in the proper sense of the word is not just having a whole lot of information up here. It's a matter of having cleansed the soul, so to speak, gotten rid of various obscurations, impurities, whatever. Now, of course, most of us, that's a lifelong process. It's a never-ending process to kind of overcome these barriers. And, the nurturing of virtue is a lifelong project. It's not something one suddenly achieves and says, I've arrived, I've done it. This kind of goes on through our mortal life. So these are a few of the ideas that we can find here, there, and everywhere. But, of course, in each tradition it gives its own flavour, so to speak, its own coloration to these universal ideas. So, Christianity has a focus on what it calls love, Buddhism, compassion, Judaism, righteousness, Taoism, equanimity, so on and so forth. So the religions, to resort to another image from Sean, are like the colours in the rainbow, the colours in a spectrum. The colour's only there because of a pure light, a white light, a coloured light, but that light in each tradition is refracted, so to speak, through the forms of that tradition and takes on a particular colour. So that accounts for the differences. In what way are all the religions the same? Well, if we stick with that image, they're all produced by light. They're all produced by the same light. Why are they different? Because the light is refracted in different ways in different religions. So here it's blue, here it's green, here it's red, here it's yellow, so on.
It reminds me one analogy that I heard recently from a Swami from the Ramakrishna order, given by Ramakrishna himself, if I'm not mistaken, in regards to God, the divine, the infinite. And the analogy was with an animal, that one people will go to the forest and see an animal and return and tell his friends, I saw a red animal. And the other, his friend would go again and return the next day. No, I saw the animal. It was not red. It was green. And the third friend will go again to the forest and return. It was not green, not red. It was blue. And so on and so forth. And they start to fight. So they all go to the forest and they find one person who was actually living in the forest in that area where they all saw the animal. And he say, all of you are right and all of you are wrong, because the animal you were seeing was a chameleon, which changes its color in different parts. Even one person say, I saw the animal and it had no color whatsoever, right? So in a similar way, the idea is that the divine will be conceived in one form, with no form, personal, impersonal, this color, that color, but we are all talking about the same divine reality. I'm thinking about, Harry, about one quote from Xuan that also you mentioned in your book. He says, if metaphysics could be taught to all, there will be no atheists. Interestingly. And at the same time, you have mentioned a few times the word elitism. So I wonder, some people may wonder, is metaphysics necessarily elitist? Or it's by nature for all? Not everyone is ready for them. Not everyone is willing to be ready for them. Because again, on one side, we have this proposal, okay, if everyone could be taught metaphysics, there will be no atheism. So the question, it begs the question, why then there is so much atheism, increasing atheism? It's because it's not taught, not taught well. The heart, the vessel is not prepared to learn the lesson. What will you say about that? Of course, that reminds me one verse from my tradition, from the Bhagavad Gita in the 7th chapter. Krishna says, from many millions of people, a few look for the truth. for those many who look for the truth, even if fewer ones actually find it, and so on and so forth. So it seems to be like an elitist statement, but yes. Actually it speaks about the willingness.
That's some interesting points you raised there. So let's just look at this term elitist for a second. So elitism, I think, is generally understood to mean that there's a small group of people who've got access to something or other, money or knowledge or power or whatever, and everybody else is excluded. They're left behind. And so elitism's got certain pejorative associations. Yeah. Elites are bad. And, of course, this idea is in conflict with the sort of prevailing value in the modern West of egalitarianism and democracy. So we all think egalitarianism's good, elitism's bad. Perennialism, metaphysics, and so on is elitist in one sense. It's elitist in the sense that it recognises that it is just in the nature of things that these universal truths will only ever be understood fully by a small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the nature of things. It's not elitist in the sense that there is a barrier to understanding metaphysics or to plunging into metaphysics. Anyone can study metaphysics. Anyone can study Shankara or the Upanishads or Lao Tzu, whoever, Nagarjuna. Anyone has access to these things if they want it. And if they have the capacity to understand, well and good. As Gaynon says, there is no property in ideas. Ideas, truths, principles, they don't belong to anyone. They're open to anyone. He says they belong to anyone capable of understanding them. So unlike most elites that we're talking about in a social or political or economic sense, they're closed. They're closed off. They're kind of living behind a wall and they're protecting something or other, their power, their money, their position in society, their status, whatever. And, of course, most of us find that sort of elitism objectionable. But the perennialists are not elitist in that sense. They're only elitist in the sense that they say this kind of understanding, this esoteric understanding, is beyond the reach of most people. But no one's excluded. No one, we're not saying, well, you don't have to pass a test to read Shankara or whatever. You don't have to come up with some sort of qualifications. You know, you can try, and if you're capable of understanding it, well and good. If you're not capable of understanding it, well, that's just how it is. We can't turn, no dexterity on the part of the potter will turn clay into gold. It's a matter of understanding how things are, the nature of things, the nature of human beings. It's a matter of understanding that on one hand, and on the other hand, of affirming these universal truths and saying, well, they're here, they're available to anyone who wants to try and enter them and have them and have these truths enter into them. There's nothing elitist there. Yeah.
Who is willing to pay the price for what it means to live a life of pursuit of the truth.
Yes, that's right.
So in connection to this, of course, again, on one side we have the notion of one truth, many facets in the Rig Veda that says Ekapsat Bipra Bahudha Vadanti, truth is one, and sages call it by many names.
Yeah.
So we can speak about religious pluralism in that sense, but also, if I am understanding correctly, perennialists will speak about, as you hinted at in the beginning, a hierarchy of revelation, right? Like the perennialists do not assert that necessarily each and every religion expresses universal truth, let's say, to the same degree.
Yes.
And you mentioned that from Xuan's perspective, he has no hesitation in telling that For example, Shankara's doctrine is more, in his opinion, profound and inclusive than Ramanuja's doctrine,
yes,
which it subsumes, but it does not invalidate, which, yes, just as a footnote, personally, interestingly, I agree with Shwana on many things. In this one, I disagree with him in the sense that, in my opinion, I'm from a Vaishnava tradition, not Ramanuja in particular, but another tradition.
Yes.
And in one sense, I think that Shankara's view is quite reductionistic in the sense that it only conceives the possibility of absolute oneness with Brahman and considers other expressions as a form of illusion till you reach that final realization. With Ramanuja, acknowledges the possibility of an impersonal,
yes,
Brahman-like experience, but also encompasses other more devotional, individual, personalistic realizations.
So, right.
Anyhow, whatever thoughts you have to share in that regard will be appreciated.
Yes, well, a couple of interesting points there. Shuan does say that all the different traditions are equal if we look at the tradition as a whole. So we have to take everything in the tradition into account.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's a proper tradition, if it's an integral tradition, by which he means, mm-hmm, the great historical traditions, not things that have appeared in recent times,
mm-hmm,
if we take them as a totality, each one contains everything necessary. So, mm-hmm, this or that tradition contains everything that's necessary for man's salvation. And within each tradition will be found all sorts of different spiritual modalities, all sorts of different possibilities, all sorts of different paths. And, of course, the Hindu tradition is perhaps the best illustration of this, because, mm-hmm, it is an encyclopedic religion. You can find and everything within the Hindu tradition.
Yeah, and I always try to make that case because people use the word Hinduism like if there is, that's only one thing.
Yes, yes.
And under the umbrella of Hinduism, you find from monism, polytheism, pantheism, yes, atheism,
yes, yes,
and everything in between, right?
Yeah. So I've forgotten where I was going. All traditions have got
whole and complete in
different forms, so that each tradition is kind of complete in itself. So, in a way, if we're interested in the perennialist point of view, the crucial thing is to try and understand the tradition as a whole, not compare this one with that one and say, well, this one's better and that one's inferior.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he says the messages, if we take the tradition as a message, the messages are the same. This doesn't mean the messengers are all of the same status or all on the same sort of level. So, mm-hmm, and the role of the messenger varies according to the tradition. So in some traditions, the message is everything. The messenger is of very little account. The message is, is what really counts. So Islam, the emphasis is on the message.
Mm.
In other traditions, Buddhism, Christianity, the messenger is the message. The messenger is the message. So the messenger has a much more central and a much more elevated position. But each messenger and whatever form the message takes, each messenger is just a vehicle for the universal truth, and in the end, that's what matters. It's the universal truth embodied in the messenger, or in the message, in the person, in the text, or whatever happens to be the form that the revelation takes in that. That's another important point I should have mentioned earlier. You know, you were talking about what are some of the ideas across all these different cultures and so on that the the idea of revelation is very important from a perennial point of view, which is to say that religious traditions are not man-made cultural constructs. They're obviously influenced by culture, they're influenced by time, mm-hmm. they take on the coloration of the time and place, but there is something that has come from above. There is something that has come down, so to speak, from above. So this means that it's not just another cultural production, as the sociologists would call them. You know, a lot of people it's like anything else. It's like, you know, literature, economics, politics, whatever. It's just something that...
Yeah, cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, just a cultural phenomenon that's created by, you know, the churning of historical forces or whatever. From the perennialist point of view, no, that's not how it is. The essence of the religion, the kernel of the religion, is something that's been communicated from above in different ways according to the tradition in question. And this is something that's always been there. This kind of link between heaven and earth is just part of the nature of things. So people in the far distant past, they were not bereft of revelation. It took different form in different places and time. But, and here's another important point, the perennialist school, following Gainon, Shuon and company, take it that the appearance of the Quran is the last of the great revelations, such as will create a new tradition. Doesn't mean there's no divine communication, doesn't mean there's no interaction, but there's not going to be a whole new revelation issuing forth a new religious tradition. The age of revelation is over from their point of view. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that point, since you mentioned that in your book.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how will you respond to the potential argument to that, to say, like, to state that a particular current of revelation has stopped with this particular prophet, in this case Muhammad? How much that may be seen as contradictory to the infinite capacity of the divine reality to manifest in time and place, even despite degradation or confusion in the world, or even especially because of that.
Yeah.
Someone may argue there's even more necessity to a particular manifestation of that perennial truth in the particular form and language that the current situation may require. How will you reply to that argument? To the point that there is no further revelation. So.
Yeah. Well, there's two points. First of all, as I said a moment ago, no one is saying that there is no more divine communication or divine influence.
Mm-hmm.
If there weren't any divine influence coming down the world, would disappear. There'd be no world. It'd be the end.
There is no hope. No more hope when we are doing this podcast at all.
Yes, that's right. So all that the perennialists are saying is that there will not be a revelation of the sort that gives rise to a whole new religion. Now, that's difficult for some people to accept, and it obviously is not acceptable at all to people who believe there have been new dispensations since the Quran. So, you know, if you're a Mormon or a Baha'i or a Subud, or, you know, these various people who claim that they do have access to a new divine revelation of the kind that leads to a new religion. So that was my first point. Now I've just lost track of what my other point was. Yes. So you're saying, you know, what about the possibility that we need a new understanding, we need new forms because of the peculiar...
Yeah, new framing of the ancient
timeless... What Shuon says is that the fundamental truths are always there, they are always available, but they cannot impose themselves on people unwilling to listen. So that the problem in the modern world is not that there aren't articulations of these truths available. The problem is that people don't want to know about them. Why don't they want to know about them? Because they've had their heads filled with anti-traditional, anti-religious, anti-spiritual ideas of one kind and another. So in the West...
And there comes the critique of perennialism to modernity, I will say, right?
Yes, yes.
Critique of humanism and scientism postmodernism.
Yes, exactly. I was going to go on to mention those things. So over the last 800, 900 years in the West, we are living in the kind of modern era. And what is modernity? Well, there are a whole lot of ways of thinking about it, depending on your vantage point. But from a perennialist point of view, the essential thing about modernity is that it's a negation. It's a repudiation of tradition, of religion, of spirituality. Those things have been moved aside in favor of humanism, egalitarianism, progressivism, and so on and so forth. So in that climate, it is very difficult for a lot of people to understand these universal truths and these traditional forms, because their heads are so full of what, from the perennialist point of view, prejudices, forms of ignorance, misunderstanding, misperception.
And the human becoming like the sole point of reference.
Basically. Yes. Yeah, man is the measure of all things, as the Renaissance philosophers wanted to say. And this is what has got us into our difficulties. And a lot of the remedies that are proposed in the modern world for various problems, the remedies or the solutions, so-called, are part of the problem. You know, in the scientific domain, this is very obvious, where, you know, science has obviously brought certain benefits and liberated us in some ways, but in other ways it's caused all sorts of problems. And the remedies are to be found outside the scientific kind of framework or viewpoint.
As I like to think many times, the main problem is our misdiagnosing what's the actual problem, right?
Yes, exactly.
Or sometimes identifying symptoms of the problem with the problem and trying to relieve the symptom, and the problem remains at the root cause there still.
Exactly right.
So, Harry, I'm thinking, going back to the point of perennialism, and to be a perennialist, as you mentioned initially, is to be committed to specific religious tradition, if I'm understanding correctly.
Yes.
And from that specific, so to say, point to pursue the transcendent unity, the understanding of the Sophia Perennis, the eternal philosophy. So in that connection, I wonder I imagine what may be your answer, but I would like to ask you nonetheless, what's your notion, your opinion about this notion of inter-spirituality that nonetheless nowadays people may entertain, like, okay, you can belong to many traditions at the same time. You can practice this or that.
Yeah.
And in somehow in connection to that, though not entirely, what's your opinion on someone like Ramakrishna, which I've seen that you've written about him.
Yes.
And he is known to have been practicing different paths at different times.
Yes.
Probably not at the same time.
Yes.
So how this all ties together with this idea.
Yeah. Okay. So Ramakrishna, I think, is an exceptional case. I mean, Ramakrishna is a saint of the first order. He's a sage of the first order. He's one of the great figures in the history of religion, not just the Hindu tradition, but more generally. Mm-hmm. And it was Ramakrishna's vocation, or part of his vocation, was precisely to affirm the universality of certain truths which are embodied in different ways in different traditions. So he lives this out, as you say. He has visions mm-hmm. of the Virgin Mother. He mm-hmm. gets taught by a Sufi. He dresses up as a woman. He's got this sort of extraordinary spiritual plasticity, we might say, this mm. kind of ability to take on, to inhabit, so to speak, the forms of different religious traditions. That does not mean that you and I and Mr. and Mrs. Average in the street can do the same thing. The ordinary person who tries to practice, and as you say, Ramakrishna didn't actually try and practice these different modes simultaneously. He said while he was in his kind of Islamic Sufi phase, he said he forgot all the Hindu deities, he forgot all the Hindu prayers, he forgot all the Hindu rituals, he didn't go to the temple, he just immersed himself in that. So even Ramakrishna's not practicing different, he's not engaging in different practices simultaneously. But for ordinary folk, and as I say, Ramakrishna is really an exceptional person. I think there are three, just if you'll allow me a brief digression, there are three really, really extraordinary Indian saints in the modern era: Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi, and Ananda Mahima. Those three are all, they've all got a lesson for the modern world. Anyway, be that as it may, for the ordinary person, the idea is to commit oneself to one religious path and stay on it. Now, if I can use two different images here, one is to say that religion is like a language. It's a kind of total system. Now, it's perfectly possible to know more than one language. I can learn French or German or Sanskrit or whatever. I can know several different languages. But I only have one native language. I only have one language that I was born into. Furthermore, I can only speak one language at a time. I try speaking four languages at once, I'm talking gibberish. You've got no idea what I'm talking about. It's mumbo jumbo. So practicing a religion is like speaking a language. It's okay to know other languages, but you've only got one native language. That is the one religion that you're committed to. Another image the perennialists often use is paths up a mountain. So the each religious practice is like walking up a path, up a mountain. Now, how many paths are there up a mountain? Well, any number of paths. You look at a great mountain, there's any number of places you can start. It's any number of different paths up to the top. What you can't do is walk, you know, let's walk 100 metres up this path and then we'll come back down and we'll go around and we'll start another path and we'll go a little bit up and then we'll go around here. You never get to the top of the mountain. You just a bit on this path, a bit on that path, you get nowhere. The only way you get to the top is by choosing a path, staying on it until you get to the top. So that's my first general point. The other point I'd like to make about this is that there's a lot of talk in the modern world, particularly in the West, about spirituality as somehow separate from religion. So people often say to me, "Oh, well, I'm not a religious person, but I'm very spiritual." Now, what this seems to mean is that they've got some sort of thirst, some sort of need for a deeper understanding. They want to understand themselves. They want to understand life and death, and so on. They want to get answers to the big questions. They think that they can do this without any resort to religion. Now, what this amounts to is saying, I think I can become an enlightened being on my own. Just leave me to my own devices and I will work it out. I don't need all this religious stuff. I don't need to go to the temple, or I don't need to say prayers. I don't need to do this. I'm just going to do it my way. So you've got all these groups that are about, you know, inner well-being and mm-hmm. you know, reducing stress and feeling comfortable and so on and so forth. That's all fine as far as it goes. But from the perennialist point of view, we are, from a religious point of view, we are born in an imperfect state, an ignorant state, and we can't overcome our ignorance and our unknowing just through the subjective resources of a particular individual,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that experience is limited. We need help.
We need the intervention of grace or the connection with a higher source, or however we may like to call it,
exactly.
Revelation,
yes.
coming from a particular tradition.
So the religions, in a sense, are like maps. You know, you're going mm-hmm. on a journey, you're going through very difficult and dangerous terrain, all sorts of hazards are out there, very easy to get lost. You need a map, you need a guide.
Yeah.
Now, I would also say, coming at it from the other side, so the idea that you can have spirituality without religion, I think is a very mistaken kind of idea, a very modern, mm-hmm. modern kind mm-hmm. of idea. But of course, people on the religious side of the fence sometimes make the other mistake, which is to say religion without spirituality, which is to say religion just becomes forms. And if that's all they are, they become empty, they become sterile, they become fossilized.
Yeah.
Spirituality is the kind of lived experience. So we've got to keep these two things together. A lot of people, mm-hmm. especially in the Christian world, have a kind of commitment to the forms, but not much spiritual life, not much spirit, not much inner life going on there, you know. So there are pitfalls on both sides. What we want is a kind of living spirit, experienced spirituality mm-hmm. within the framework provided by a religious tradition. Mm-hmm. And again, to go back to Huxley and the difference between Huxley and Schuonze, is that Schuonze is mixing the different religions, mixing the different elements. You know, I'm going to do a bit of Buddhist meditation, and I'm going to say a Christian prayer, and I'm going to go on a Hindu pilgrimage. All of this, you just end up with a confused mess. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that we can't learn from other traditions. We can honour mm-hmm. them, respect them. We can learn something from them. We can integrate perhaps something from another tradition mm-hmm. into our own spiritual practice. But what we can't do is just create a kind of stew. I like this bit of Taoism, and I like that bit of Buddhism, and I like this bit of humanism, and I'm just going to mix these all together and make my own particular recipe, my own particular concoction. That just leads to a kind of scrambling.
I was also thinking that many times when people may say something, things like, I'm spiritual but not religious, I generally ask them, but what do you understand by the word? Again, what's the word religion for you? Because for many it's more institutionalized, external ritual, or they may get triggered by knowledge of abuse of different sorts done in the name of God. So many times it's more an overreaction to religious, institutionalized religious PTSD than what an actual... The actual word religion entails religare, relink, reconnect, yoga basically is also connect. Sometimes I joke saying for people, some people yoga is just put your legs over here like a pretzel, and actually yoga means union, communion. Yeah. Some people religion means a sterile, external, formal, institutional thing. Well, actually it's synonymous with yoga in sense of reconnection and linking, both words mean the same, right? So, generally very much insisting on what do we mean by each word, right?
Yes.
So, Harry, as we're wrapping up, I don't want to take much more of your time, but one more thing that comes to my mind, especially because I'm in this recent By the time we are recording this episode, I will be in a few weeks publishing my third book. And in that book, I tried to address, it's called Evolution in Divine Love. And my premise basically is, according to my tradition, Vaishnava tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. Of course, we acknowledge God is changeless. God is always God. The truth is always truth. But also we conceive the possibility of God's experience of love evolving, growing in his changelessness. So we do not see that as a contradiction. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering, which are, for example, the very word Brahman that you referred a few minutes ago, that many times is used to refer to the absolute in the Upanishads and the Vedas. And interestingly, the word Brahman comes from the Sanskrit dhatu or verbal root brim, which means to grow and to expand. So for me, it's interesting because many times the notion of Brahman is more seen like an unmovable, unchanging entity, which I'm not against of, but at the same time, the word speaks about the form of growth and expansion. So I'm curious about your understanding of the perennialist's view in this connection of how, of if there is a possibility of a peaceful coexistence, let's put it that way. Of changelessness in God, in the absolute, but also a form of expansion and evolution in the experience of love on the foundation of changelessness, of course.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the I have no problem with what you're saying. One of the sort of, what should we say, one of the hallmarks, one of the characteristics of wisdom, I think, is the ability to resolve certain dualities, to kind of transcend certain dualities, and even perhaps to reconcile what appear to be opposites, coincidentia oppositora, Carl Jung used to write about. And before I go on, I think it's Meister Eckhart who says, whatever you say about God is wrong. Whatever you say about God is wrong. In other words, any kind of conceptualization, any kind of statement about Brahman, the absolute reality or whatever, is limited by saying this, we're excluding that.
Yeah.
So we have to try and, you know, ultimately we want to overcome these dualities and these oppositions. And so I have no problem myself with the notion that Brahman, we can think about it, we can conceptualize it as an unchanging reality. We can also conceptualize it as growing, expanding, evolving, although I don't like the word evolving because of its particular associations, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. So these are two apparently contradictory ideas, but from another point of view, they're two aspects of the one reality. So I'm fine with that. I'm fine with what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm fine with that as well. Yeah, actually, our main... The name of our philosophy, basically my tradition, is Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva, which basically means reality is paradoxically one and different.
Yes.
You know, there's unity and diversity. It's a peaceful coexistence of paradox, basically.
Well, this is a very important idea in perennialism too. I'm glad you brought this up because what the perennialists are not in favor of is trying to reduce the marvelous richness and diversity of religion to reduce it to something singular, abstract, grey.
To one thing or the other.
Yeah. What we want is, on the one hand, we want to understand these changeless truths which are to be found everywhere, but we don't want to dismiss or reject the diverse forms in which those truths are manifested or expressed. So at the same time, we're valuing something singular, universal, unchanging, and we're valuing all the richness, the color, the diversity of the different religious traditions. We don't want a sort of, you know, religious globalization, so to speak. We don't want something like, you know, McDonald's, which is all over the world. We don't want religious McDonald's outlets, all the same, everywhere, all over the world. We want to retain the diversity, the particularity. As we were discussing when we were talking about the esoteric and the exoteric, it's the particular and the universal.
That reminds me of one quote from Sean. Maybe we can close with that. He says that if God were on one side of one religious form only, the persuasive power of this form will be such that no man of good faith will be able to resist it.
Yes, right? Yes.
Yeah. So, but that's not the case. So that speaks about the diversity, but the unity also in that diversity as well.
Yes, and Kumaraswamy puts it quite nicely too, where he says, religious pluralism is not a matter to be tolerated. Because, you know, there's a lot of talk about tolerance. We need to tolerate.
Religious tolerance, yeah.
He says, religious diversity is not a matter of toleration. It is a matter of divine appointment, which is to say that diverse religious pluralism, religious diversity is providential. It's divinely appointed. It's in the nature of things, and we need to understand that. Otherwise, we get into exclusivism and interreligious warfare, and which of course is a terrible problem in the modern world because the growth of fundamentalism of one kind and another. This is moving in exactly the opposite direction from everything we've been talking about, and that's where we find ourselves. It's a very, very unhappy spectacle.
So Harry, thanks so much. It has been an honor, a real joy to have you here. And as we conclude, I don't know if there's any final thread you would like to leave our listeners with, as something to ponder as they navigate the paradox of a changing world and unchanging timeless truth.
Right. Okay, there's two things I want to say just quickly in conclusion. One's a very mundane point, and that is that you've referred to my first book there, Traditionalism, Religion in the Light of Perennial Philosophy. That book was published in 2000, but it was written in 1980. I was still quite a young man when I wrote that book. Later on, I wrote another book called Fridtjof Schuon and the Perennial Philosophy. Now, everything that's in that book, the Traditionalism, pretty well everything that's in that book, apart from one or two chapters towards the end, everything in that book is in the new book as well. But the new book is a much more detailed and more nuanced and more mature expression of the same material with some other things added. So I just make this point in case there are some listeners who might be interested in coming to
Perennial. So part traditionalism has been pretty mature for me, just to be fair about it.
I don't think it's, I don't, you know, I don't reject anything in that book. I'm not saying I'm not wanting to disown that book. I'm just saying that the later book is a fuller and better account, I think. Mm-hmm. So if people want a starting point, if they're not already familiar with all of this stuff, if they want a starting point, the second book is a place to go. Now, you're asking me whether I've got some, you know, final words of wisdom or whatever to say in the light of our discussion. Something that I often say when I'm giving talks and so on is that, unlike you, Swamiji, I'm not a spiritual guide. I'm just a scholar written about these things and tried to shed a bit of light on some important questions. So I don't generally dispense spiritual advice because that's not my role or my function. But, of course, people do ask me about various things because I've written books and been studying those things for a long time. Recently, I gave some talks in America, and I concluded the talks with a few remarks about spiritual practice, and I talked about two ideas that are pervasive in Shuan's writing. So perhaps I'll just mention them as a nice point on which to finish.
Yeah, please.
But the two things that I was emphasizing, and of course one could have chosen any number of things, but these were the two that I alighted upon, so to speak, are the importance of A, faith, and two, prayer. Now, again, we could find different words for these things, but what does Shuan mean by faith? He doesn't mean what people seem to think faith means, which is believing things that are unbelievable. That's what people mean. That's not it. What he says is faith is the fixation of the spirit on the absolute. Fixation of the spirit on the absolute. So we need to keep in mind, that we're not, we're living in a world of relativities. We're living in this world of time and space where everything changes. But we need to know that there is something that doesn't change, and we need to know that we are in some sort of relationship with that. And that awareness, that bringing that to mind, that is what Shuan calls faith. So this is critical in all religious traditions. Might be different words used to describe it, but this kind of commitment, if you like, this commitment to finding the truth, this commitment to finding what's universal, finding what's not just subjective and relative, what something which isn't just to do with the fact that I'm living in 2025 in US or Australia or wherever, beyond all that. And the other thing is prayer, but again, a very wide term, meditation and prayer overlap in all sorts of ways. We need to, religion, Shuan says, you know, metaphysics without spiritual practice is an imposture, it's a fraud, it's hypocrisy. If we're serious about trying to find answers to these sorts of questions, we need to be doing some sort of spiritual practice. And prayer and meditation are universal. You know, they have their own coloration in each particular tradition, but they're universal. So whatever else is going on, whatever else is happening in someone's life, whatever confusions they've got, whatever difficulties they've got, if they can retain some faith and they can say prayer, then they're pointing in the right direction. Not going to be easy. Life isn't easy. Finding answers to these questions isn't easy. But if we're oriented in this kind of way, well, we're pointing in the right direction. It's better than heading off downhill in the other direction, so to speak. But anyway, thank you, Swamiji, for the opportunity to have this discussion. I've enjoyed it very much, and I'm honoured and privileged to be part of your podcast, and I wish you all the best, and I hope we'll keep in touch.
Thanks so much.
Thank you,
Harry. My pleasure to meet you.
Okay.